If you were here last week, you'll remember that I invited folks to answer the question, what do you mean when you say God? And I can't stop thinking about what it felt like to do that and about the fascinating collection of answers. We got some serious range, people. We had everything from fairly detailed theological answers to we can't know, or there's nothing. There's no knowing this, and sort of everything in between. And to me, that just felt like it pointed to us being a community that includes some bold, honest explorers, and just the kind of folks that I feel deeply privileged to journey with. So I had all of that floating around in my memory and my heart going into Monday in my consideration of what I might offer us as a catalyst this morning. I kind of half-joked last week that I might talk about money today since it's the AGM afterward, but I've decided not to. I could sum up what I would have said about money in two sentences anyway. I'm grateful for all the ways this community is sustained by those that participate in it, including those that give financially. And I feel like the leadership team does a great job of being responsible with that trust, and I look forward to the ways in which we will continue to work together to make something we want to be a part of. So that's there. That's the money talk, at least my part of it. Details to follow. But back to last week and where that's led me this week. So I had all of that kind of good stuff about those questions and responses going off inside of me. And so that was kind of my conscious context. And in that conscious context, I heard someone in another context pose this question. What was there in the news today, or if you haven't seen the news today, what was there in the news recently or this week that was done in the name of God, and how does that intersect with what you mean when you say God? In the interest of time, I'm not going to offer that as an open question for discussion this morning, at least not during the talkie bit. If you want to take it up over lunch, you know, of course. What I'm going to do instead is offer some things that have come to me in my reflection on that feel like they touch on it. In the 80s, I had the privilege of spending some time in the Middle East working on a project with my dad. I've talked about that trip here several times. It changed not only my perspective on the Middle East conflict, but I can also fairly say that it changed my life. When we were on that project, we were living and working with Christian Arabs who lived in Israeli-occupied West Bank at that point, in particular in the town of Ramallah, which is just outside of Jerusalem. And this put me, a thoughtful but really pretty naive boy of evangelical Christian heritage, smack dab in the middle of what remains one of the most long-standing and complex political, religious, land-based conflicts in history. And as someone that grew up connected to that evangelical branch of the Christian tree, I kind of thought I knew how this story went. You know, I thought I knew who the good guys were, who the scary bad guys were. I kind of had a concept about what land belonged to whom and why, who the usurpers were, who God's people were in this story. And then I met this guy that was our host, Ari Rantisi. Ari is an Arab, you know, one of the bad guys, and a Christian. A man who had been educated in Jerusalem as well as in the U.S., someone who spoke several languages, who was a bishop in the Church of England, from a Canadian vantage point, an Anglican by any other name, and one who had at one point been the mayor of Ramallah. He was the guy who, in a Palestinian community functionally controlled by Israel, he was the guy who had to make the decision to close the school his own daughter was in because of bomb threats on more than one occasion. Sitting at his dining room table, surrounded by the orphans of war that filled his home, and by the way, he did not discriminate in his care for the victims of war. Palestinian, Israeli, all welcome. Sitting at that table, I heard a story I thought I knew in a way I had never heard it before, and it blew my mind. I've often wondered how to tell this story in a way that gets at just how deeply it rocked my world and in a way that might convey some of what I felt like I began to learn during that time, but without that telling becoming some kind of lecture or story that smacks of you need to think as I do about these matters. My thinking got changed so radically in that experience that, and looking back on it, I realized it couldn't have been changed any other way. That's hard to convey. But anyway, this week, I felt like I came across some things that feel like they come close, like maybe they offer some possibility of sharing this story and its impact in a way that is invitational rather than that sort of thumps people over the head with a personal experience and suggests that they should all have it. First of all, a short poem. The poet is Yehuda Amichai, a contemporary poet. He lived from 1924 to the year 2000. He was an Israeli poet, highly regarded, thought of by many as the greatest of his contemporaries. Someone who was born in Germany and then immigrated with his family to Palestine in 1936. He fought in the Israeli War of Independence as a young man, but subsequent to that became an advocate of peace and reconciliation in the region, working with Palestinian writers. And he was discovered, I have that in air quotes in my notes, that's a very colonial sort of perspective to say he was discovered by somebody the English-speaking world regarded well, but with that context, he was brought to the English-speaking and English-reading world in 1965 by the English poet, translator, and children's writer Ted Hughes, very well-known, well-regarded English poet, who later translated several of his books. Anyway, in the reading of and hearing of this poem, I think that'll help us get a little deeper grasp of it. Here's the poem. Some of you might already know it. It does keep popping up. It's a powerful piece. It's called "The Place Where We Are Right." From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. But doubts and loves dig up the world like a mole, a plow, and a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. Let me read that one more time. From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. But doubts and loves dig up the world like a mole, a plow, and a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. In the words of the Quaker elder, activist, and educator Parker J. Palmer, nothing new can grow between us when we speak to each other from, quote, the place where we are right, close quote. When I was in Aurirantisi's house, I wasn't just immersed in a different version of a story I thought I knew. I was immersed in love. His love for these kids, his love for the naive Canadian boy across the table from him who thought he knew how the story should go, his love for the world regardless of race or creed or land claims. And that experience utterly plowed up the hard and trampled ground of the place where, quote, I was right, close quote. It ruined the ideological house in which I hid from the complexities of the conflict. It took away my shelter. But in the same moment, it began to dismantle a barricade that made it hard, if not impossible, for me to love in the generous, world-healing way that Aurirantisi did. I realized as I was writing, sitting alone in my office with tears just like pouring down my face, that it didn't just overturn something then, it continues to overturn something today. It's what came to mind when I thought about our conversation last week about some of the challenges present in the tensions surrounding pipeline development across traditional First Nations territories, protests near rail lines, histories of broken trust and violence, like all of that. It's relatively easy to fall into a conflicted conversation about something like that. There are so many different dimensions to consider. There are so many possible perspectives. So here's a question to ponder. With that particular conflict in mind, what might be the loves of the people involved in such a conflict? Is it possible that most, if not all of them, love the same things? They love their children, their grandchildren, they love this land, they love the natural world, they love the possibility of a hopeful future. And what might they all doubt? Perhaps perhaps we, in a situation like that, might share the doubt that what is presently being done is not what is best. Is this what is best? I doubt it. How might the conversation be different if it started with the sharing of loves and doubts instead of positions and solutions? Of course, something needs to be done. And of course, we're not all going to agree on the solutions. But isn't it likely that the conversation would be more productive if it started with common ground, with what we love and what we wonder about or doubt? For what it's worth, I think Jesus would probably have found a lot to affirm in Amichai's poem. I think Jesus must have known that love and doubt can plow up the hardest ground in our lives, can ransack the places we hide, can make possible the green of new life in a field that looks for all the world like it's dead as a stone, can still the howl of our own opinions so we can hear the whisper that says, love one another, even when you doubt that it'll work. Peace.